On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we are heading back to the 90s with Sexy Beast on Paramount Plus, jumping into some volatile situations with Vicky McClure in series 2 of Trigger Point on ITV, and getting entrepreneurial tips from a notorious cartel boss in Griselda on Netflix. Plus, Lulu Wang stops by the show to discuss her new show, Expats, on Prime. I'm James Dyer. And welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, your essential guide to every show that matters, and a podcast that would like to spare a thought for a grave miscarriage of justice. And no, we are not referring to Mr. Bates versus the post office again, but rather justice for Better Call Saul, hashtag justice for Better Call Saul, which made history this week. It set a record for having the most Emmy nominations, 53, without a single win. Wow, an extraordinary snub there for one of the all-time greats. But before we get into all things Emmys, I should introduce my two co-hosts. Boyd Reddy!
Wow.
Kay,
you really built up
Reddy!
To that.
Oh
my God.
Oh yeah, we're ready, James.
Glad yeah, that's it, that's it.
Did you watch it this weekend?
Of course I fucking didn't. There was still breath in my lungs and strength in my limbs. So no, I didn't watch Gladiators.
Okay, and pomposity fine. In your
and pomposity in my head. Yes. No, I didn't watch it. Though I hear it was very good.
It was a lot of fun.
It was excellent.
Yeah. Did they knock each other off the poles with the Q-tips?
They did. Yeah, they did that. The what are they called? Those things.
The pugils.
Pugil sticks. That's it. Yeah, ridiculous. Ridiculous knife. Yeah, it was huge amounts of
fun. Is there like a new wolf and a new jet and a new Spartan?
All of those things.
Yes, there's very much a wolf character. He's called Viper.
Oh, so they have new names. They haven't dusted off the old names.
Very much all got new. The personality of
Right,
wolf.
So he's a bit grumpy, a little bit mildly.
Yeah, aggro.
Yeah, aggro Bob.
I interviewed them all.
Did you?
Yes.
For this? What, for Heat?
No, for my friend's sport, culture and style magazine, Circle 08. And a high end, by the way. And we did a feature on Gladiators, the first one, really. And I interviewed, like, not there, I think there are 18 in total, maybe 16 or 18. I interviewed 12 of them.
Well, I mean,
in a series
what
of.
What questions did you ask them?
I will tell you. But I interviewed them in a series of entertaining Zoom, multiple Zoom meetings.
Oh, right.
So I did like three at a time or four at a time.
That's a nightmare to transcribe.
It was absolute. Fucking nightmare to transcribe. Yeah, exactly. So I really earned my money for that, I tell you. What did I ask him? A lot of stuff about, you know, why a lot of them remember the original show or their parents loved the original show. And so the kind of origin story of them and how they got involved in the show and, you know, that kind of fairly basic stuff. And they're all like, a lot of them are like Olympians and, you know, they have some amazing stories. One of them was like in a bobsleigh team at the Olympics.
Cool runnings.
Yeah, very cool runnings.
Amazing.
And they're some of them are really massively cocky. The men, as you'd expect. There's one guy, and do you remember which one? I can't remember the name of him. You know the
legend.
Guy? I think he is legend. Mm. Yeah. He's just in basically in shorts and a, they're all wearing lycra, like huge. He's basically wearing lycra and shorts and a tank top. That's his costume.
On the call?
they were in normal clothes. On
wow.
The, most of them anyway. But he's so like cocky about himself and his body. And he's people are going to love me. He's like talking about, you know, everything. I was like, what's your best asset? He's like, everything, you know.
Are they in character?
A lot of them are. Not all of them, but a lot of them are. Okay. I'd say the men notably more than the women. The women seem more chillaxed about that whole thing. I'm just very happy to be there. But yeah, anything you want to know about the Gladiators, well, at least 12 of them, I can tell you pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I do in my spare time, James.
Well, now that we've got the Gladiators chat out of the way, shall we talk all things Emmys?
Yes.
This is a new like menu item.
Is this
like
any other business?
Order. This is
AOB.
This is TV news though.
Yeah, it is. I don't know why he's doing this.
But we're bringing it up top.
He's had a lot of caffeine and sugar today. Yeah.
We've had to wait a fair few days because obviously the Emmys happened at the beginning of last week. You know, it's been a week on.
Yeah.
So I feel like we should get it out of the way lest we feel like we're behind the conversation.
100%. Yes.
So
you're right.
Better Call Saul was robbed. That's my top talking point.
Yeah, I mean, that stat you read out, it is incredible. I kind of predicted it, though. I thought, I didn't think...
3.
I didn't think it was going to win much. I always read the, you know, the predictions, like Variety, you know, and Hollywood Reporter do have their experts predicting who's going to win. And I think Variety predicted that Bob Odenkirk would win Best Actor. And I was like, he will not up against those Succession guys. And he didn't, sure enough, Succession. And interestingly, Kieran Culkin won the lead actor, which I thought was fascinating. Not Brian Cox or, you know. But I knew he wasn't going to win. I knew she wasn't going to win.
Well, okay, so here's a question I have for you. How much of it do you think is because, you know, the unassailable beast that was Succession was there? And how much of it is the fact that Better Call Saul feels like 100 years ago? Like, it feels so long ago. Like, oh, is that this year? Yeah. Really?
Oh, I said that last year as well. Yeah. Because I was worried about that.
Because it always happens, doesn't it? By the time the Emmys come around, Better Call Saul's been out for so long.
100%, yeah. 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 And, you know, even longer because this is always delayed. These Emmys delayed after because of the strike.
Yeah, so, that's right. But we did talk about this when they got snubbed last time. Mm. Oh, no, it'll be next year. It'll be for the final season. They'll finally get the recognition they deserve. No. But their final season comes at the same time as Succession's final season.
Yeah, it's a shame.
It's a massive shame.
On the plus side, Elton John got an Emmy.
Oh, yeah.
And he's an EGOT. And the person who won that, as well as Elton John, is my friend Ben Winston. Ben won didn't you see him? Didn't you see Ben Winston wielding the Emmy for this show? He produced the show.
Oh, I thought he got EGOT.
We just thought he'd stolen it.
No, Ben Winston won this Emmy. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he produced the show and for Elton. And Elton thanked him specifically in various posts.
Ben is unstoppable.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. This is the guy. He was doing like work experience on Skins like 25 years ago. I met him on set. We hung out at the Edinburgh TV Festival. He's now literally ruling the world.
Are you claiming to have made Ben?
He made himself. He's literally ruling the world of TV, winning Emmys left, right and centre, and I'm still doing the same thing I did 25 years
ago. And he supports Arsenal.
But did he talk to 12 gladiators?
No, he did not. James, you've got boys
too
back.
Too right, mate.
Yeah.
Too
That's right.
Anyway.
Cling on to that.
And we've got a friend of the pod one as well, though. Mark Mylod, who we've had on twice, the director of lead director Succession One, outstanding director for drama series. Very pleased for him. Lovely guy.
Jennifer Coolidge.
Earth. Yes.
Recognised.
I mean, she's one of the few non-Succession winners in all the other
Along
categories.
With...
she thanked the evil gaze.
Yeah,
funny.
That was
Very
a great
funny.
Reference. Quinta Brunson.
Yes.
For Abbott Elementary, which, as you know, I love. I was happy about that.
Yeah.
Did you hear that Daniel Radcliffe wants to do a rom-com with her?
Yes.
Because they are of a height.
Yeah.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Someone's got to sort that out, haven't they? Basically, the big winners were the Bear, Succession...
Beef
in their different categories, weren't they? But they pretty much kind of almost shared out all of those things, apart from the odd, like, supporting actress or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, drama series Succession, I think, was always going to win that, even though The Last of Us is obviously the best thing in there. But...
lame interjection.
So comedy series, obviously, we go in the comedy series, The Bear... One comedy series.
We should just say though, I don't want to.
Slag the Bear.
No. It's just not a comedy, is it? It's just not now a comedy.
Are
you going to tell me?
No, it's not.
The central episode, the fishes and the forks rather, throwing the forks. That is not a comedy.
The whole show is a drama.
But basically, if it goes in the drama category, it's never going to win against Succession.
She's not wrong.
I know, but it's just madness.
Yeah,
just...
I agree with that. I don't think you should be able to pick and choose genre based on preference.
I'm happy for that. Like if it's like in podcasts, if we were going for an award and we could win our category, I'd be like, fuck it.
It's like when the Golden Globes, who are, as we've mentioned, batshit, put in The Martian for comedy. And it's just like, I'm sorry, what? Yes, there's a joke in it, but calm down.
It's crazy.
But interestingly, also in comedy series, Jury Duty is in comedy series. Now, some people refer to that as a comedy and some people refer to it as a reality show.
Mm. Yeah,
and it is kind of both of those things. Isn't it? It's a scripted comedy and it's a reality show.
Did you watch it?
No. Because it's at least 50% reality show.
Yeah. He's ruled that out.
So that's completely out.
But that has more comedy in it, arguably, than The Bear. The Bear series too.
And The Bear has some funny bits in it, but it is not a comedy. It's not primarily run for laughs. There aren't that many laughs in it.
No.
It's a drama with comedy elements.
Yeah, so is The West Wing, and that was never up for West
Succession.
Comedy.
100%.
Succession is more a comedy than The Bear.
And it is, honestly. It is. Succession is going for bigger laughs than The Bear, is my contention.
100%, yes. Yeah.
If Succession was in half-hour chunks, unlike The Bear.
So we've established that the Emmys are bullshit. That's good.
Basically.
Lead actress in the drama, Sarah Snook for Succession. Great speech. Very, very good. Lead actor in a drama, Pedro Pascal for The Last of Us. Oh, no, that's right. He was robbed. It was Kieran Culkin for Succession.
Kieran was great last season, though.
Yes, and everyone does say that Roman was the MVP, so that's good. Limited or anthology series Beef, as we've mentioned, which was very, very good indeed. Obi-Wan Kenobi was nominated for that, which is whack.
Crazy.
Lead actress in limited or anthology, Ali Wong for Beef, and Steven Yeun for Beef, also in the category for actor. Directing for a drama series, Mike Mylod, Succession. Blackbird won supporting actor in limited or anthology series.
Again, one of the very few. Yeah, limited
Paul Walter-Hauser.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah, one of the few non-Beef winners in that category. Yeah. And he is brilliant in that. Absolutely brilliant.
Trevor Noah walked away with a Talk series one. John Oliver walked away for Variety series one. Very exciting. RuPaul walked away with one as well. What else have we got?
Walking away, they've decided.
I mean, they weren't wheeled away. Well, they did legitimately walk away.
Sure, but I don't know. It's just funny.
He's trying to make it a thing. Let him go with it.
Repeatedly walking away. Yeah.
Fine. Is there anything else you would like to pull out? Is there anything Monster, the Jeffrey Dahmer story. So that one... Best Supporting Actress,
yes.
Nisi Nash-Betts.
I don't know. Neither do I.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, I think you've covered most of it.
Yeah, I mean, it is basically, think of the categories. It's either Beef, The Bear, or Succession.
Exactly.
And that's basically the
Which
entire
stretch.
Very apart consistent. From Jennifer Coolidge, as you say, she gave the very funny
Quinta speech. Brunson.
And Quinta Brunson.
But everyone else, it's The Bear, at least it's Beef, consistent. Or Succession.
Yeah. Mm. And unlike the BAFTAs, which are batched, today's BAFTA film just came out. I know this is a TV podcast. Don't get me started, but just to say, Andrew Scott... absolutely robbed in a scandalous.
Who can we blame for that? KK, do you know anyone who's voting, who might be responsible for that?
No, but I didn't get in the acting categories in BAFTA now, in the BAFTA Film Awards, it's a jury and the acting chapters that vote on the nominations.
Is it
we
like
only
jury
get to vote
duty?
For the winners. I get to vote for the winner.
Oh, so you don't get to see the nominees?
No. It's interesting. It's very interesting. No, I think they need to really look at this because I think it's gone wrong. I think it all started as an attempt, you know, to deal with issues of representation, etc. Which is far, absolutely has to be dealt with. But I think it's because something's gone weirdly wrong because the nominees are odd, I think, in the acting categories. And for Andrew Scott, and the supporting actors in that film are nominated, quite rightly. But for him to miss out, it's one of the most ludicrous things I've ever seen.
He feels very strongly about it.
And he does.
He did tweet about it.
BAFTA. Coming for you.
But it's interesting. So the actors vote on actors to get the nominations, and there's a jury as well. And I think they vote three each. And for some reason, it's gone horribly wrong. Anyway, I won't bang on about it because I'm sure you'll be addressing these very important facts in the Empire Film podcast.
Yes, of course we will. Well, it's the live show.
Oh, it's the live show. I could invade the stage and talk about it.
You could.
Again.
Yeah. Come on, boy. Storm the stage.
Bring soft fruit. Start pelting games.
Are you coming down?
I mean, I haven't been invited, James, officially.
What?
Come down. We can hook you up, boy.
Oh,
you
James,
can ask a question.
James, poor form.
What?
Come on, an invite should have been extended a long time to go to Bordeaux.
Of course, yeah.
Delivered on refreshment.
100%.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. What else do we want to talk about? Oh, we should move on to the traditional way that we start the podcast. What we've been watching. Kay, what have you been watching this last 7 days?
Okay. I have been watching, and I'm not going to give any kind of apology for it. I've been watching Traitors, James, and the only reason I'm talking about it because Wednesday's episode was so epic that I can't not talk
Who's
about
the
it.
Baby-faced stealth assassin?
Oh, that's, yeah, Harry. Oh, Harry. You saw my tweet.
I saw your tweet about the baby-faced stealth
because
assassin.
Because last night's episode was so good. Oh, can I talk about it? Do you think people get annoyed about any spoilers? Well, they will have seen
it. Well, this won't go out. Bear in mind, this will go out on Monday.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
So you're probably fine.
But there's spoiler warning, and then you just have to fast forward if you don't want to hear anything.
Yeah, please fast forward if you don't want to hear Traitor's chat.
Yeah, I mean, look, James.
I'm already skipping.
He's already zoned out.
He's mentally fast forwarded.
Well, it was just basically, it had everything. Like, it was camp, it was high drama, there was, like, betrayals. It was just so good.
You know my favourite funny verbal tic about the babyface assassin guy? What's his name?
Harry,
who's a traitor, one of the two traitors left. Spoiler alert. Is that he keeps referring to everyone as yourself and himself. So he goes, the reason myself voted for yourself was because himself. I was like, what is this weird? Everything's self this, self that. He's so weird. Anyway, that really tickles me every time he says, the reason I voted for yourself. Yes, all right.
But it was the best hour of reality TV that I've ever seen in a long time.
So, like, hang on. So you're saying this is better than the first series of the Trojan.
Yes.
Oh,
this,
yeah.
This,
oh,
this, this, this specifically is one episode. This specifically
okay, just
as
this
well.
One episode.
No,
okay.
All of it's great. The second season is great and possibly better than the first season. But it was this one episode was so well done and had so many twists in it. And you couldn't predict how it was going to go. And there's a woman called Diane who is like a legend, must become a dame. And there was just like this, she left the show, but in such a spectacular style.
Are the tasks still an absolute shambles?
Well, one of the reasons I think it's better because the tasks are better. I think they've rethought the tasks a lot and they're much better. And so the task in this episode that Kay's talking about was brilliant. It was really dark, like horrifying.
Well, three of you run,
it was
four of you get rifles, 20 minute head start.
They were marched into like a funeral march for the person who was going to be murdered. And the person who's going to be murdered by the traitors, in quotes, had to lie in a coffin. The three candidates had to lie in coffins. Actual coffin.
How did they know they were going to get murdered?
They didn't know. So the three people didn't know.
No.
One of them.
It's a
very confused.
Okay. It's a complex. It's quite complicated.
No. I'm going to really
formula
quickly.
Point. It doesn't really matter.
No, wait. The end of the previous episode.
Yes.
If someone drank out of a specific goblet, they had died, but they didn't realise. Right?
But they were handed
the traitor
it by
gave the them a goblet.
The traitors had to poison someone and kill that in full view of everyone there, and by
Fire
giving
a
them a goblet, a particular goblet of drink, and so the person was poisoned in quotes. Diane,
but didn't know it,
and she didn't know it was her.
And then they said, three of you have been poisoned or something.
There were all candidates to be poisoned. There were candidates to be poisoned. They had this long
funeral
march.
Down. The group was whittled down to three. One of them, they knew that one of them had been poisoned. There's three of them just walking along, didn't know which one of them was dead, a dead woman or man walking, and it was Diane. And do you know what, James? The biggest twist is that her son is in the competition that no one knows about it. So her son was having to watch his mum being buried
nice.
In a coffin. Yeah.
It was so good. So
attended
good.
The funeral of his mother, effectively.
Lovely.
Like a rehearsal, But it is so that was a task, and that task was much more engrossing and, you know, amazing and weird and freaky and, like, horrific than anything in the last series, really.
It was a gothic thrilling moment.
Yeah, and they've had other tasks that would be much better. So I think they know that was one of the few weaknesses of series one, I think, were the tasks, generally.
Yes. Everyone acknowledges it.
This time, so much better. And they all seem to be giving much more time. The round table was like start halfway through the show.
Mm.
Like literally half an hour, practically, of, you know, the round table, which is where they decide who they're going to vote off, basically, they're going to get rid of.
It's so good.
It's in all seriousness. I know I'm not saying this is going to persuade you to change the way you think about these things, but there is a real art to this show, an absolute skill, storytelling skill, and brilliant, brilliant kind of conceptualized. I like this idea of them poisoning someone in full view. Of the others was such a great idea, and it had so many ramifications to it, and you know, and the idea of having a woman and a son in there has turned out to be brilliant, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Things like that, they're just great little kind of ways of spicing up the whole thing, and it's film brilliant. Claudia's amazing, you know,
she is just
Claudia,
relishing
like, absolutely,
her role,
yeah, relishing the whole this fake funeral thing, you know, wearing a veil and
Grim Reaper, if you will.
It's just brilliantly done in this genre. It is the Rolls Royce of reality.
Do you know how many people have tweeted me and said, "Oh, go on, get James to watch it, he'll really love it." And I'm like, listen, he's a close-minded.
Yeah.
No, to be fair, like you had me watch the first episode of the first series of The Traitors on Pilot Plus, and I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
I genuinely thought it was very good.
Yeah.
And I did say, and again, I do genuinely think if I did not have so much stuff to watch.
What, rewatch?
Or rewatch.
Yeah.
Or stuff I want to watch.
So much stuff you just want to watch.
I mean, look, I watched five episodes of The West Wing this week, I think. Five episodes.
James, of
The West
Wing.
If I didn't have vital things like The West Wing to watch, I would watch this.
I'm not saying you have to watch Traitors. I am saying you have to have an open mind. And any time you talk about rewatching something now,
it's a comfort watch.
It's something. It's an illness, as Boyd says. Anyway, so the second thing I've been watching is My Life with the Walter Boys on Netflix. It's a teen drama.
My Life with the Walter Boys?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Oh, no, I thought I'd make it up. Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, it's called that. I'm not saying it's a good title name, but yeah. It's about a young girl whose parents, whose family died tragically, and she has to go live with her guardians who have, I think it's like 10 sons or something.
The Walter Boys.
Yeah. And there's a couple of the brothers that are vying for her affections.
Yeah. So it's like YA.
Yeah. But I found it quite enjoyable. It's an easy watch, and I got quite into it, so I've watched five episodes of that.
Didn't know about that.
What are you doing now?
It's on Netflix. Netflix.
Oh God, I got all your jokes.
I just haven't seen it. You know when you see stuff go by, although I have had trouble with my Netflix account, people. I forgot my PIN number, which has just been ruined my life today.
Boyd has been banned from Netflix.
Yeah, I've been banned from Netflix. Oh, interesting, yeah. I'll check it out. It's worth checking out, is it?
Yeah, I think it's quite a decent team drama. Yeah. Okay. I don't think you'd necessarily get into but yeah. Okay.
I mean, James loves a teen drama.
I do love a teen drama, it's true.
But he's got the West Wing to finish.
That's true. Urgently.
Yeah, that's true.
What have you been watching, James?
Other than the West Wing.
Yes.
Yes. No, so I watched the West Wing on Monday. So what was Monday? Last Monday.
Martin Luther King Day.
Yes. Yes, Boydie. Because it was Martin Luther King Day, I watched the West Wing. No, Monday was Blue Monday. It was the third Monday in January. It is statistically, mathematically the most depressing day of the year. And I was having a really shitty Monday. And I was so excited when I found out about Blue Monday, which I'd never heard of.
I mean, you're the only person who's ever said
that. Because I suddenly had something to hook it on. I was like, oh, there's a reason why this is such an awful day. But because I was having a dreadful day, I watched a lot of the West Wing to kind of pick me up. So that's what I did on Blue Monday. I watched a lot of the West Wing.
See, wait a minute. If you hadn't have found out that Blue Monday is a thing, would you have actually watched any episodes of the West Wing?
Yes. I was sort of managing my mood generally.
You had your own Blue Monday, which hadn't been defined as such.
But then I had a label for it, didn't I? It's Blue Monday. Brilliant. Yeah. I've got an excuse.
Most people want to avoid labels. James need the labels.
I need the labels. Give me all your labels. Yeah. I finished watching The Walking Dead, Dead City, which I have to say picked up. I was interested in the Negan character work. I'm not going to go into any details because we'll be reviewing it at some point. Yes. And it's not out in the UK yet. But I was there for the Negan character work. There's some very interesting stuff in there.
Okay.
And the other thing I did was I watched the rest of and finished Criminal Record on Apple.
Oh, was it good?
Which is very good. And obviously, it's a bit twatty of me because obviously it has an air for everyone else and people can't watch the rest of it. They can't binge it. But fair enough. But it is very much worth sticking through to the end. I really enjoyed it.
It's only six episodes, isn't it?
It is eight episodes.
Oh, are you sure?
Yes.
Okay. I keep asking if they're sure. I don't know why I'm doubting it.
Really. I know, like when Netflix.
No, it's eight. Eight episodes and it's really good.
Okay.
So, yes, I enjoyed that a lot.
Oh, I really want to see the rest of that, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
I couldn't watch the rest of that because I had to watch... I'm catching up with For All Mankind because I'm in a race against time, listeners, to do the Pilot Plus. To do the Pilot Plus, which we're recording tomorrow, Friday.
The spoiler special.
Spoiler special. James isn't doing it. It's too lazy because he's watching fucking every episode of The West Wing.
Do you know what? You really have stitched Boyd up. Incredible. You really have.
Yeah, it's incredible.
He's refusing to watch any.
I am like 20 episodes behind those.
Yeah, well,
Listen, how could he possibly find the time when he's too busy watching The West Wing?
It is true. Yeah. Although some people have been trying to get me to speed up by saying that there is an online conspiracy theory, sort of fan theory, that For All Mankind is a prequel to The Expanse. This is absolutely true.
Oh my
people
God.
Are talking about it because they were talking about mining in the belt, in like the asteroid belt, and they said this is an origin story for The Expanse.
There are similarities.
And they're trying to get me to watch it because it's part of The Expanse.
What's that other show you're obsessed with that we always make fun about you for?
I'm not sure you've narrowed it down that much.
With the puppets and everything.
With the puppets?
Yeah, you know.
Sesame Street.
No.
The puppet. Farscape.
Farscape. Yeah, you know what's happening with Farscape? I meant to say this, I think last week, I found this out. They're putting it all on ITVX.
Oh, are they?
Yeah,
all of Farscape is going on ITVX.
Yeah, yeah. Why would you tell
him
that?
Wow.
There was an actual email about it.
I sent a rewatch.
Yeah.
we have no chance of him ever watching anything new again now.
Yeah. James insisted back in the early days of this podcast where Terry was doing it, Terry White, of Legendary of Empire. He forced Terry to watch an episode of this.
I'm not watching fucking Fire Escape.
And it's literally got Muppets in it.
Yeah, it has got. It's a Henson thing.
Yeah, it's a Henson thing. So that was funny. I meant to tell you that.
What else have I watched?
So yeah, For All Mankind. I've nearly finished in time for the podcast record tomorrow. I hosted I have hosted a Q&A this week, last night in fact, for Here We Go, which is one of those shows which is really, really good, but because it's a half hour, fairly mainstream comedy, James won't let us review it. So I might as well mention it now. I think it starts on the 1st of February-ish, something like that. And it's brilliant. Series 2.
You had a good lineup of panellists, didn't you?
Great lineup of panellists, the whole cast basically. It's Tom Basden, who's in Afterlife with Ricky Gervais. And
the brother-in-law.
The brother-in-law, and he writes and produces and stars in Here We Go, which is about this family, this fairly dysfunctional family. Alison Steadman's in it, Catherine Parkinson's in it, Jude Coddy plays the son. So the conceit of the whole show is that it's all being filmed by the son, the teenage son, And he's filming it on his camcorder. It's actually, you know, it's and he's making a documentary about his own family. So every single thing is filmed by him. It's quite clever. And then he also messes around with time quite a lot. So he'll start in the present day and flashback. And a lot of kind of story points are established in the flashbacks and flash forwards and stuff. It's really clever and funny. He's brilliant. He's talented. And he's really stepped up this season. Second season's even a lot funnier than the first. Catherine Parkinson has an amazing set piece where she gets drunk with some students. She's a mature student. She gets drunk with some young students in the house, and it's fucking hilarious, honestly. So
what,
yeah,
channel?
BBC One, Friday the 2nd of February, 8 o'clock. Here we go. That was brilliant. So I had to watch, you know, various episodes of that. I finished Big Boys.
Did you?
Oh,
yes.
Don't tell me anything.
I'll just tell you, I'll say that episode 6 is, as a lot of, not just I'm saying it, but a lot of people
Everyone's saying it's
absolutely brilliant. Yeah, it's all about Shannon having a baby. And so it's kind of like, there's a certain amount of tension there, but it's really funny. There's really funny medical characters in there who are just like having their own whale of a time rather than taking seriously the fact that this poor woman's about to go going into labour. And then there's kind of all stuff going on about the main characters' lives as well. But it's just brilliantly done. And I won't say any more on that because I'll end up spoiling it.
I really want to watch it, but equally I'm kind of slowing down because I don't want it to be over.
And there's an episode, which I think James will particularly like, where they do work experience. And John Poynting's character goes to a lads mag, which is an online lads mag, in fact. But it's edited by this absolute brilliant, coked up bellend of a character who is brilliant. The observation of him is fantastic.
Not very realistic, then.
Well, I mean, it's totally realistic, yeah. And there's his staff of, like, you know, underlings, are brilliant. And there's one woman working there, and it's just brilliantly handled. So, yeah, that whole thing. And Llewellyn's character, he goes to the radio station, helps out with the radio. Oh. And the DJ woman is really funny as well. So, like, when they take it out, when they bring new characters in, they do it so cleverly, they cast so brilliantly. Mm. In that. And yeah, whoever the guy is who plays the lads mag editor, it deserves the best supporting actor role.
Can I just say another thing? I'm just going to bring it back to the Tracers very quickly. Because Jack Rook was tweeting about Tracers because he loves it. And you know Diane, who I mentioned, who's just like this formidable woman, he was saying if she does go out of the series, which she did, he wants to cast her in the third series if they get one as an exam invigilator. Amazing. She's a teacher in real life. So fingers crossed for that.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
That's it?
I don't know if I can talk about the fact that I've watched Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Well, you've just done it.
I know, but I might have to tell.
It's in. It's on the record. It's out there. It's too late. It's too late.
Yeah. Coming soon,
indeed. Right, fine. Shall we have this week's listener question, Kay?
Yes, we shall. Okay, this one comes from the Rebel MC, who's at MCMCMC. I feel like I read that out last week. Did I? That sounds familiar. Anyway, they want to know, if you know a show is going to be a large number of seasons, 4 or more, and the fact that not many shows appear annually these days, brackets 18 months to 2 years between seasons seems to be the norm, does it put you off from watching, and why the long wait between seasons? And they continue and said, when I read Yellow Jackets was going to be 5 seasons, my heart sank, same as when I saw The Last of Us second game would be 2 or possibly 3 seasons. And when you have a nearly 2-year gap between seasons, who can remember what happened?
We don't always get a 2-year gap between seasons. The Last of Us was a victim of the writer's strike and also the actor's strike, let's not forget. So production was delayed. Otherwise, we would have got season 2 of The Last of Us, I would have thought, this year. And as it happens, we're going to get it next year. So sometimes you can't foresee these things. But yeah, you're right. Not all shows are annual. Some of them do take a while to come back. Does it put
me off? Like Mrs. Maisel.
Yeah, like Mrs. Maisel, yes. Does it put me off? No, because I guess I don't really think about it in the moment. I don't immediately, like, when I'm watching it, all I think about is, this is brilliant. And then when it finishes, I'm like, oh.
Do you know what? I actually thought you would get fixated on that.
No, I don't get fixated on that at all. You know, don't get me wrong, I want all of it now. But I don't. So with book series, sometimes if there's a series of books, I will sometimes wait for the series to be finished before starting it, or at least until the final one is written and going to come out at a certain day, because otherwise you get into a George R. R. Martin situation that nobody wants. But I don't do that really with TV shows.
I am the same then. So I don't like get wound up if I know there's going to be a long wait in between series, even if I get really into it, because I just enjoy it, as you say, in the moment. However, the thing that I lose my shit about is Slow Horses, when you know it's been filmed
and
we're just having to wait. Mm-hmm. So that makes me angry.
Yeah, that's upsetting.
But just because I'm just so desperate to see it. But yeah, ordinarily not. What about you, Boydo?
Well, first of all, the reason it happens, and it does happen more and more, is just because you're effectively now making, you know, movies. You're making, you know, like Stranger Things is the obvious example, right? It started in 2016 and they're only now starting to finish the next series 8 years on, yeah, which is the fifth series. There was a 2.5-3 year gap at one point, I think, between Stranger Things series 3 and 4. Yeah, July 2019 series 3, May 2022 series 4. And it's just such an ambitious show. I don't think they can. I don't think they could possibly physically and mentally create all that stuff, all that amazing Stranger Things-y stuff if it was an annual show. And
it's particularly difficult for them because they're working with kids. They're not anymore.
Well, I mean, somehow they're going to have to deal with that. Yeah, so the kids will be... I think they're lucky in that quite a lot of those kids are quite baby-faced, even though they're now in their late 20s or whatever, early 30s, some of them. But they just have to deal with that. But yeah, that is a classic example, I think, of a show whereby you can't hurry it because it's so ambitious and every episode is a film. Yeah, I mean, Succession, there wasn't that long a bigger gap. Succession was generally like 18 months between series.
That feels a long time.
Oh yeah, but I would say, but again, Succession, every episode of Succession is a massive undertaking, you know. So but it has spun off into, like, here we go. The second series of that, which I mentioned in the What We've Been Watching section I hosted last night. I think it's 2 years since that first series, you know, and that's just like one, Tom writes it all himself, you know. So I'm not, you know, it's even then, it is. So I would say it's increasingly rare for a show to have an annual series pretty much a year on each time. It is becoming increasingly rare. So it's a good question. It's a good point. And I think it does. I don't know, it makes you think about things. It doesn't bother me either, apart from, as you say, you know, when you're waiting for something to arrive. There's often a massive delay in particularly terrestrial dramas for some reason. Like, you'll know that something was finished like a year ago and still hasn't been put on air.
Well, Sherlock used to have massive gaps between seasons,
yeah,
didn't it?
It did, yeah, that's true.
It's just, you know, you get kind of used to it. I think you live in the moment, you love it while you're watching it, and when it's finished, you just mourn it until it comes back. Rewatch stuff in the meantime. But I one thing I will do though is if a show is great and I know it's been cancelled, 9 times out of 10 I won't even start it. Like I'm not doing that. Like if it does get a proper ending regardless, I will do. So Counterpart being a great example. Counterpart is fantastic. It's one of my favorite shows. J.K. Simmons is wonderful. That did get cancelled, but it's 2 seasons and it does have a proper ending. So you're like, okay, great, you know, that's fine. But not always.
You just reminded me about Julia being cancelled. I'm still so angry about that.
Yeah. There used to be that channel, didn't there? Fox. Fox had a channel called Fox, you know, and the British or European version of Fox was literally every single show they showed was stuff that's been cancelled.
Because they picked them up cheap. Like, literally. This is the thing that used to drive me mad. And Sky used to do this sometimes. They make a massive deal. I remember there was a TV show called The Circle, which is about witches. And they were like, the new show, the hottest import from the States. It's like, literally, it was cancelled 6 months ago. What are you talking about? And it's like, they're making such a meal out of this show. It's like, you will never know how this show ends ever.
Whereas now, they put a huge amount of effort into the marketing and publicity for shows that have been cancelled. And now we don't get any marketing and publicity at all for shows that are going to be brilliant, that take ages to arrive, like Feud, the Truman Capote thing, which should be on Disney Plus at the end of this month, but I don't know if it is.
Okay, well, remember about your blood pressure, yeah?
Yeah.
So, good question, Rebel MC.
Yeah, very good question.
Good. Well, that was our listener question. If you would like your question answered on the Pilot TV podcast, do send them into, I was going to say me. No, send them to Kay, for she is the post mistress of the Pilot TV podcast. Kay, how do you like your messages? How do you like to receive them?
On Twitter, me or to Pilot. And then I also go onto Instagram, and then James curates them from the subreddit.
Yes, sometimes.
Well, listen, this is on James. I have delegated this job.
Right, okay. If I see good ones on subreddit, I will give them to you. But you like them sent to you on Twitter or sent to Pilot TV Pod on Twitter or Instagram, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
Correct.
Excellent. Let us have a guest. Specifically this week's guest, which is none other than Lulu Wang, the writer and director, best known for films like The Farewell. But she's on the small screen this week with her new show, Expats, which stars Nicole Kidman and a load of other great people in a story of the lives of a group of, well, expats, living in Hong Kong. We sent the owner of the finest head of hair in all of Christendom, Empire's John Nugent, to talk to Lulu. And this is what happened.
So congratulations on Expats. It's such a wonderful TV show. I guess, first of all, how does it feel just to be showing it to the world now? You're finally showing it to people.
Yeah, it feels like a relief, you know? It's been such a long process, and I'm just glad that people are that it exists and that I finished and that people can watch it.
Yeah. I mean, am I right in thinking Nicole Kidman approached you for to direct the whole piece?
Yeah, well, she initially approached just to direct maybe the pilot. She didn't have really any expectations. But once we started talking about it, that's when, you know, I decided that I would direct all of them. Mostly just because I don't know how to do anything else. Like, I've only made films. And yeah. So I just kind of knew that I could make another film, even if it was 6.5 hours or however long, but that ultimately I could shoot it like a film.
Yeah. What was that first phone call like when you first spoke to Nicole?
Quite intimidating. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I was kind of raised to have skepticism around everything. And so I was quite skeptical about it and just didn't think it would amount to anything. I thought, oh, okay, you know, this is what happens. The movie's doing well. So all these people are calling. That's cool. But in what world am I going to make something with Nicole Kidman? We come from such different lives, you know, experiences and backgrounds. And then, you know, we ended up having dinner and talked, you know, more in depth about the book. And she was incredibly supportive of my vision of it.
That's amazing. Yeah. What kind of like collaborator was she? Because she's an actor and a producer on this, right?
Yeah. And she really, you know, it was great to see her exercise her different skill sets in different parts of the process. Like in pre-production, she was reading drafts and really advocating for my vision in the drafts and always wanting to make sure that what we were making was something that I really believed in. And then during production, she became really much more of an actor, just an actor. And I only say just because she emphasized that she couldn't do both. Like she needed to relinquish control, right? And so much of producing is about having control and, you know, influencing. And she didn't want to influence, you know, as an actor. She wanted to be able to let go of everything and just lose herself in the character and in the story that I wanted to tell.
And what was it like for you? I mean, your last project obviously was The Farewell, which is such an like intensely like, personal project. What was it like to take on someone else's story, essentially?
You know, I mean, when I first read Janice Y.K. Lee's novel, The Expatriates, the reason that I resonated so much with it is because I actually did see myself in so many of these characters, you know, Mercy is Asian American. She is grown up in New York. She goes to Hong Kong as an expat, but no one sees her as an expat. They're very confused. They're like, are you a local? Okay, no. Oh, you're Korean. I get it. And she's like, no, I'm actually American. And so seeing that character in a world like this, I haven't seen that before, right? Exploring Asian diaspora around the world. And then, you know, the privilege of the Margaret character and Hillary character, these are people that I also know, because often when I go back to Asia, it's with Westerners. You know, I studied abroad in Beijing. And when I went back, people were like, what's your relationship to all these white people? Are you their translator? I was like, no, these are my classmates. We're all here together. I'm also American. And so I just felt like I could connect with both sides of it, both as a Chinese immigrant who grew up in America, but also then going back as an American expat.
There's so many things going on in this story, isn't there? There's so many sort of themes. I mean, one thing that I really responded to, perhaps having gone to Catholic school, is this theme of guilt, you know, is that there's like it's a really sort of resonant theme. I mean, was that something that was felt very, very potent for you?
Yeah, you mean specifically with Mercy?
Yeah.
I mean, I just found that element of it really intriguing when I read the novel, this perspective of the perpetrator, of somebody who calls themselves a perpetrator. And that was the intrigue part of it, the mystery, the dark. There was a darkness that ultimately carries us the arc of it is going from this darkness to light. And so for sure, there's several like religious like threads in there, including a married couple who struggles with how to deal with grief, and they both have their own ways. And whether that's, you know, to look towards religion or to be actually very against looking towards religion. But ultimately I did want to, you know, portray a sense of finding grace somehow, whatever your method is, whatever your path is, of how to go from this darkness to light.
How did you find the adaptation process? Because this is, like you say, it's taken from a novel. Like, what? How did that translate into 6.5 hours of TV?
I really enjoyed it. You know, I highlighted, circled a lot of the stuff that resonated with me, but we were tremendously fortunate to have just like an incredible room of writers, including Janice YK Lee, who wrote the novel, and having her perspective in the room was incredible because she's, you know, this is the world that she created and she's lived. And then Alice Bell as well is somebody who was developing the project very early on with Nicole. Her family are, for many, many years, were expats in Hong Kong. And through them, she experienced that life. And there's a lot of Australians also in Hong Kong, and yeah, she's Australian. And we had a lot of Australians on our show, not just Nicole. And Vera Miao, who's one of my best friends, as well as just this incredible genre writer director, Taiwanese American who was born in Guam, and Gersimran Santu, who's a Sikh American, and we all brought our own experiences and traumas and perspectives, and it was also wonderful when we disagreed, because I think that when we disagreed, when you're in a room, you know, oftentimes in life, if you disagree, you're just like, I'm not talking to this person, or, you know, I'm going to mute them on Twitter or whatever, you know, you do. But like in a room, you have to work through that and come to a storyline that you can all agree. At least that's how I run my rooms. I wanted everyone to ultimately support the story we were telling. And so it was wonderful to kind of talk through our different perspectives and ultimately figure out how to put that into the story.
Yeah. And then when it came to shooting, how was the shoot? I mean, I imagine a huge operation, like you say, 6.5 hours, and you're filming on location in Hong Kong. Like it seemed like at times like kind of organized chaos it must have been.
Yeah, we were shooting in Hong Kong during a global pandemic. So yeah, you can imagine. A lot of moving pieces. You know, we have the storm episode. And so it was like trying to just pray to the weather gods that we got rain for the rain scenes and sun for the sun scenes. And it didn't always happen that way. But, you know, it still felt like an indie film to me, even though the resources we had were tremendous. But we had to be scrappy so often on set, you know, and I think that's my team. I brought my entire team from The Farewells, my cinematographer, Anna Francesa Solano, and my production designer, Young Ok Lee. And so we just are so hard on, you know, these women are so hard on themselves. They're often like, this is such a huge challenge. And they just really rose to the challenge. And I loved seeing them rise to the challenge and be able to pull off sets at a scale that they had never done before.
Yeah. You really get a sense of the place of Hong Kong. I mean, did you get a chance to like spend time there, explore it as, you know, just a tourist?
We were there for almost a year, between like the research period, location scouting, and the shoot. So yeah, we tried to just be locals as much as we could, but obviously, you know, there was also an awareness that we were expats, right? Because we were in a bubble, both the bubble of production as well as just all of the hotel we were staying at, you know, so it's impossible to kind of really truly be a local. So but you know, on weekends I would have my assistant take me places, and that was always fun. but it's an incredible city.
Yeah. Did I read somewhere that you hosted like bubble tea parties or something like that?
I think it wasn't a party. We just drank bubble tea. Okay. I mean, I think that, you know, everything, like the stories become larger than life.
Sure, yeah.
But that was actually in Culver City in our writer's room. Okay. That to kind of get in the Hong Kong spirit, we would just walk down the street and go get bubble tea. Okay. But yeah, I'm a beverage person. You know, I'm like when you see me writing, I've got like four different beverages at all times.
Do you have a favorite bubble tea flavor? Is there one that particularly stands out?
I'm just, you know, classic Hong Kong milk tea.
Yeah.
You know, with brown sugar boba.
That's a good tip. That's a good tip. I wanted to ask because, you know, obviously you come from the film world and this TV show is very cinematic, but it is a TV show. And, you know, unusually it's being screened at London Film Festival on a big screen. I don't know, what did you approach it like a film or did you think of it in more TV terms? How did you think of it?
I think that, you know, I approached it like a film in the sense that we shot it like a film, right? Like we were crossboarding, we were shooting like in this location. And so we were jumping around, shooting scenes from this episode, shooting scenes. So all out of order. And, so that in that way it was like a film, but then in other ways the way it was like the only time I really thought of it as a TV show was like in that it had to be chapters, right? So each episode was its own chapter and it had to work on its own, but it also had to work as part of a whole, particularly episode 5, right? It's not a standalone film. People are going to have to watch it in the context of these 6 episodes. So I didn't want to make it feel repetitive in information that people already gathered from previous episodes. But then I also wanted to screen it at festivals where people had not seen the other episodes or earlier episodes. So I had to make sure there was enough information that to orient the audience in the world.
Mm. Did you like it? I mean, would you come back to doing more like long form storytelling?
I think so. I mean, it felt like a novel, you know, in many ways it felt like writing a novel. And I really love the ability to jump perspectives and play with form in television. Like we could just have bottle episode and do this and completely surprise audiences by where they're going next, as opposed to picking up exactly where we left off before.
Well, whatever you do next, we always look forward to your work. Thank you, Lulu.
That was John Nugent and Lulu Wang. Shall we move on to the world of news? We've covered the Emmys, but what else has happened? Boyd?
The BBC put out a picture of Jenna Coleman from her new show.
That was my news.
Was that your news?
No,
you do it.
Jenna Coleman, she's going to be in BBC's The Jessie, a 4-part series about a fire tearing through a holiday home in a scenic Lancashire town. She plays Detective Ember Manning, who must work out how it connects to a podcast journalist investigating a missing person's cold case and an illicit love triangle between a man in his 20s and 2 underage girls.
Correct. It looked a bit. I think she's got very good
detective
taste.
Face.
No, and that, yeah. Jenica, I think she does good stuff generally. Like she's picked good things to do since she left Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. There's loads of White Lotus casting news. I mean, this has been drip-drabbing.
But some good casting this week. We had Walton Goggins.
Yeah.
We had Patrick Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
What?
And Amy Lou Wood.
Amy Lou Wood, best of all.
Storming people.
Yes. So they joined, as you say, previously announced cast, Jason Isaacs, Leslie Bibb, Michelle Monaghan, Parker Posey. I mean,
remember my prediction that Jason Isaacs is going to be the hotel manager?
Yeah, I know, you're gaslighting me, Kate. That was my prediction, everyone.
His groundbreaking prediction from a few weeks ago.
Take the piss out of that. He may not be. Like, anyone could be the manager of the hotel. Walton Goggins could be the manager of the hotel.
It's not. It's going to be Jason Isaacs.
Well, you were saying that. We'll see. Anyway, what a fucking cast. Fantastic. I mean, literally, now, he could ask anyone to be in this show, couldn't he? Mike White, the creator and writer of the show, and everyone will want to do it. It's such a brilliant thing to be part of. So, yeah, it's very exciting.
HBO and Max Content Chairman Casey Bloys apparently has alluded to the fact that there will be a third season of Big Little Lies, which I'm delighted about. This comes on the back of Reese Witherspoon telling Variety that we are working on it. Nick and I have been working on it a lot. But yeah, so it looks like it's definitely going ahead. So that's another one that there's been a big gap. We need them to hurry the fuck up.
Oh, God, yeah, completely.
One thing that did tickle me a little bit is...
is this news or is this like your weekend plans? You,
yeah. It's not a weird sex thing. David Benioff and Dan Weiss of Game of Thrones fame were talking to The Hollywood Reporter, and they were asked what they would change about Game of Thrones if they could do it differently. And they isolated one thing that they would have done differently. I'll give you £1,000 if you guess what it is.
The one thing that changed about Game of Thrones.
The one thing they would do differently about Game of Thrones. You're not going to guess it, so I'm just going to tell you.
Give me £1,000.
Yeah, come on.
It's not going to help, Wayne. Whatever it is, you're not going to guess.
All right.
They wish they'd brought back Mord the Jailer.
So, right.
Yeah. Mord the Jailer, who is the jailer in the Eyrie that Tyrion Lannister pays off to get out of his sky cell. They thought that he should have come back. And the point is that there is a scene in a tavern later on. And they thought Mord should have been the tavern owner and now be a small business owner based on the money that he got from Tyrion. And this is the thing that they would have changed. Let me just leave that with you there.
That is absolutely brilliant.
It is mad, isn't it? Yeah. In other news, Kate Herron. The wonderful Kate Herron, who directed, among other things, Doctor Who.
Yes.
And Loki is going to be working on The Last of Us Season 2.
Oh, yeah.
That is exciting. And while we're talking about The Last of Us Season 2, there were lots of rumours this week or excitement that you might get a Bill and Frank spin-off show. That is not happening. That has been shot down. Craig Mazin has said, no, there will not be more Bill and Frank.
He hasn't just said no.
No, he didn't say
no.
No.
He turned into Kenneth Williams for some reason. Oh, my God.
No.
Wowie.
Yes. Never go full Kenneth Williams.
I don't think I ever... did I do the in news that Curb Your Enthusiasm, the final season, is starting, the start date of it?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either. So it starts...
Break it now.
It starts in America on Sunday the 4th, here on Monday the 5th. On Sky Comedy. And I am going to say at this point, I can officially announce that I've interviewed Larry David.
Well, I don't know why I'm gasping because I obviously knew this. It's very rare that boy gets super you get excited about stuff. That was the caveat. You do. Yes. But you don't get nervous about things. And you were like nervous because obviously you just like love Larry.
Nervous
and
excitement.
He's, yeah.
Yeah. There are a few people in the world, as I would say, that I would rather interview. And Larry David, yeah. Literally like Bob Dylan, Elvis Costello. It's like a handful, I would say.
Yeah.
Thierry Henry.
I know you can't tell us too much, but did Kate Bush live up to your expectations?
He completely lived up to my expectations. I was really, because he's such a, obviously the character of Larry David in the show is this exaggerated, curmudgeon, is that the right word? Kind of difficult guy. He's a difficult guy. That's the whole point of the show,
Tricky
character. And so I was like, you do, and he himself talks about how the character is what he would like to be like in real life and how much of him there is in the character. So you're just slightly, I was daunted by this iconic figure talking to him. But I had like 45, 50 minutes with him on the Zoom and he was a delight. He was absolutely delight. He was like, he was just so funny and nice. He was exactly as I expected on if it was going to be a good mood and funny. And he's enough like the character to be really, really funny all the time. So, he's like constantly saying just every little aside, it was brilliant. So... And he just, I got to ask him, like, what's your favourite episodes and all that. Just stuff that you'd really genuinely want to know if you're a Curb fan. So, yeah, so that will, you'll see that at some point soon somewhere. Yeah, so it was one of the highlights of my entire life.
Oh.
Was interviewing Larry David. Yeah. Imagine when that email came through from saying, do you want an email? I was like, I tried to be calm.
Yeah.
Gave it 30 seconds before I replied. Yeah, no, absolutely, totally lived up to it. I got a Zoom selfie at the end. I said, do you mind if I could take a picture, a screen grab of us, doing the Zoom together? And he went, no, of course. And I did it. And then he literally went, I don't think I was smiling in it. So do you want to do it again? I was like, yeah, thank you. Just like, dude. And then I go, just, he smiled in the end. So yeah, the whole thing was a dream.
But presumably you're going to demand that they give you the video of the entire interview so that you can have it for posterity.
I haven't as yet demanded, but
you should.
Yeah, I should, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's bits of it that are going to be embarrassing because, you know, just me saying, oh, yeah, that was brilliant.
But
that
it's
was
a Curb Your Enthusiasm interview. Surely those are the best bits.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You couldn't curb your enthusiasm. There's no shame in it.
It's exactly. True. Yeah. Yeah. So I've gratuitously mentioned that in the news section. But the news is, I mean, February 5th is the final. And it is the he was very firm. Spoiler alert. Not even spoiler alert, but I asked him repeatedly if this is it's definitely going to be the
what
final
number,
season. It's 12. This is the 12th season. Yeah, 12th and final season.
Is that a good run?
Yeah. Yeah,
I look forward to not watching it. Right?
Have you never watched
your
any
kids
of it?
Cringe? You know I have. Like we've reviewed it on the show, and like because it is super cringe.
Oh, it's the ultimate.
Yeah,
cringe.
Exactly. It's like it's like torture for me. It's actual torture for me.
And he literally was talking about how he cannot get enough. The things that he finds funniest are the cringiest, most difficult, awkward, painful moments.
No.
He loves it,
and it's
so infectious. The love of that. Yeah, it's funny how how it's almost designed to be.
It causes me physical pain.
But didn't we force you to watch it?
Yes. I've watched a few.
Yeah.
And each one has made me die inside.
That's brilliant.
Is there any other news?
No.
No.
Might be, but to be brutally honest.
Apple TV did unveiled first look pictures at a comedy adventure series coming called The Completely Made Up Adventures of Dick Turpin, starring Noel Fielding and also Hugh Bonneville.
Do you know what? I've seen clips from that. I went to an Apple event at the Apple HQ in Battersea, and it looked really, really good.
That's
incredible
fancy.
Cast. I know. Yeah, before Christmas. Yeah.
Thanks for the invite.
Well,
no, I'm saying to Apple.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, you know, they can't invite everyone.
Hang on, wait a minute.
Darren, please play the prick klaxon.
can we just say this week that Kay got a screener before either of us?
Oh yeah, what was that?
Oh yeah, what was it?
She did, yeah.
It was one of the shows reviewing.
Point.
It was Trigger
yes,
Point.
It was
Trigger Point. We were like, I was like, oh God, I haven't got the screener. Boyd, if you got the board, I haven't got the screener. And he was like, yeah, I don't know if we're gonna get to the end of the week. And Kay was like, I've had it for days.
No, I didn't say that. I did say I won the dick swinging competition and sent an aubergine. Because that never happens. But yes, ITV sorted me out for you guys.
They hooked you up.
I did a little cartwheel.
That was exciting, I have to say. Yeah, that was. There was talking of Apple, they did talk about the Dick Turpin thing, which is called The Completely Made Up Adventures of Dick Turpin.
Which I literally said.
Yeah, no.
Oh, right.
Oh, sorry. I
thought you were doing that title thing where you're not believing me when I say a title.
Well, I had that as well, a little bit. Did you talk through the cast?
I said Noel Fielding and Hugh Bonneville.
Mark Wootton, Tamsin Gregg, Asim Chowdhury, Mark Heap, Joe Wilkinson. It's an A to Z of current kind of comedy people, British comedy people as well. But they also had the trailer for their fashion drama.
Ooh.
Yeah, do you know about this thing? Yeah, this is Juliette Binoche as Coco Chanel.
Oh, wow.
And Ben Mendelsohn as Christian Dior. And it's called The New Look. And that's on middle of February. We're reviewing this soon, James, almost certainly. So it's another high fashion haute couture
by the end of
drama
this
for us to
high
watch.
Sewing.
Yeah.
By the end of this year, James will be in couture.
And
I? Mm-hmm. And all I'm saying is, if they're going to portray either of these people as tortured geniuses who are really horrible to their staff about every single fucking little detail of their dresses, then I'm going to be furious.
Yeah.
Heard it here first.
Well, on that note, I believe that's the end of news and time to move on to the reviews section. And first up this week, we have Griselda, which is Netflix's biographical drama about Griselda Blanco, the notorious cartel boss, and apparently the only person Pablo Escobar was ever afraid of. So who better to talk about this then than a woman scarier by far? It's Kay Rivero.
I knew you were going to go there. Yes, as you say, this opens up with the quote, "The only man I was ever afraid of was a woman named Griselda Blanco," so says Escobar. And so immediately you know that this is based on real life and you're in for like this romp, like drug-fueled, crime-laden, violent ride. And I think that Sofia Vergara, who plays Blanco, is really good in this. First of all, because the prosthetics and makeup are fantastic, right? So at first, you almost don't recognise her because she's had so much done to her. Mm. And I read that actually Blanco's son in real life sort of complained that they'd made her too ugly. But yeah, I think Vergara really just goes for it. And I found it really interesting because, I knew nothing about her. And you hear so much about Pablo Escobar. And she was like known as the cocaine godmother, who was this really ruthless, violent, like drug lord who was a central figure in the Miami drug scene. And when we meet this character, she's basically breaking up with her husband, who is a drug trafficker and a bad one at that. She flees from Colombia to Miami with her kids, and she's trying to find somewhere to live. And, you know, you think she's going to go on the straight and narrow, and she just wants to, like, get away from this incredibly violent, manipulative piece of shit husband. And actually, we find out very swiftly that she has smuggled out a kilo of cocaine,
yep,
of Colombia's finest, and she wants to get rid of it. So ostensibly, you think, you know, she's going to shift this cocaine, she's going to go on the straight and narrow, but actually she's not. She wants to establish herself. But of course, the people already there, the Miami drug scene, the big wheelers and dealers of that situation, just don't want her there. And it's incredibly, there's spectacularly violent scenes, especially at the end. It's almost like comic how, like, violent it is. But yeah, I really enjoyed this, and I just thought it was really interesting if you don't know who this character is. And I think Sofia Vergara particularly is the standout.
Yeah, it's Lady Scarface. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's particularly because it's set in the 80s in Miami.
Where, is it the 70s or the 80s?
Spoon starts in the 70s, goes through the 80s, I think. As I'm talking about the Al Pacino Scarface, not the original Scarface, but it's the down to. I think there were shots in this. You know, I know I've said this. I'm obsessed with Brian De Palma. He's one of my favorite directors of all time. Tragically, not mentioned when in the Empire podcast when they went through all the best directors like ever. I was like, why are they mentioning Brian De Palma, you fucks? Anyway, so Scarface, which is obviously one of his masterpieces, is all about gangsters in Miami doing cocaine.
Mm.
And so I think this is like she has, and the story wise, this is, you know, how someone goes from nothing in Miami to a Latin American thrust into that world to becoming a drug, in her case, queenpin rather than a kingpin that he is.
And she's ruthless, right?
And of course, that's the
brutally
whole thing.
Brutally violent.
So that's what I was going to say, is that I think the way they did the violence, like there's one amazing shot of a, I won't spoil it, but that was like, I'm sure that is a Brian De Palma shot that they've copied. And the whole look of it with, you just naturally have a similar look of 70s, 80s gaudiness and drugs, just cocaine everywhere, like bars and clubs, apparently. In any bar or club in Miami, you just sat there at the table snorting cocaine.
I do think that there's a bloke who literally pulls out a key of cocaine and cuts it open and starts snorting it in the middle of a crowded bar.
That's just how it was. That's a disco scene.
The 80s, man. Like, it was wild.
Exactly. That's exactly how it was. So I really enjoyed it. I wasn't that excited about this, as you were talking very early, to how excited I get about stuff. So on the scale of how excited I am about a show,
you weren't Larry David excited.
Right. So, you know, Curb's at 11 out of 10 or 20 out of 10. I was like not that bothered.
Same.
Because also from the Narcos, I got quite bored with, even though every Narcos fans are very, very clear that, you know, that was a show that was always had a level of quality to it all the way through, all the way to, you know, to the kind of the sequels and the spin-off and everything. And I'm sure that's true. I just got a bit bored with it. But this is really good. I mean, I thought it was really, really good and very pacey.
Yes,
like, you know,
it was. Yeah.
Really well judged. And as I often say about stuff, within the first few minutes, you're like, you're absolutely within this world and you believe it. I totally believed her character. I mean, I'm slightly off put by the prosthetics, and it reminded me a bit of Bradley Cooper in Maestro, where you know he's got a prosthetic nose.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know she's got a prosthetic nose.
I don't know if you know it as much. I think it's just because you know
she's such an iconic figure in Modern
Family.
If you didn't know,
Sofia Vergara, you wouldn't.
Right.
My point was, if you didn't know who she was, the quality of it, you wouldn't know.
Of course, but because you do, I'm completely like, it's her from Modern Family with a nose, with a percentage nose.
Gloria.
So yeah, Gloria, and she's fucking brilliant because this character could not. Gloria is such a frothy, funny, you know, carefree figure in Modern Family. And this is like the absolute opposite. She's completely ruthless, intense, and just kind of by sheer force of will thrusts herself into this world of these men. And it is extraordinary how good she is in it. So I think it's much better, much more exciting than I expected it to be.
I love this moment when confronted by these arrogant dickheads and she just starts wielding a baseball bat and you just don't mess around with her. She's not taking any shit.
Yeah.
It's super gripping. Like, it's incredibly gripping. It's the same with you, but I was a bit like, really? Must I? I really didn't fancy it. And it did vastly, you know, go beyond my expectations. Like, I was completely hooked by what was happening.
Yeah.
And you're right, the shocking violence is not the only show this week that has shocking violence. But
it's been a very violent viewing week.
It's been a violent week, yes. Do you know what? There's a lot going on in all three of the shows this week. But yeah, this is really good. Really well shot. just great.
Yeah. And to give credit to Netflix, because I sometimes, you know, critical Netflix of not publicizing stuff, new stuff. And there are, like, there are shows in that I still want to watch that we barely even told about in the world of Netflix that people are, readers, listeners are telling us about on a daily basis, which is fair enough. But they did go hell for leather with Griselda. They had a big premiere, they had a big poster campaign, and they know this is really good. I think they've definitely done the right thing by this show.
Actually. And it's worth noting, would you say it's 75% Spanish language?
Roughly. I think it gets more as it goes on. I've only watched the first episode, but I've read reviews. I think it gets more English language as she and the family.
Yeah, because it's not a completely Spanish language show.
Because she's dealing with Americans in Miami as well.
Indeed.
Yeah, and apparently there's I was reading. I actually will carry on watching it as soon as I can because reviews I've read in America have certain episodes coming up that are really big and bold and ambitious. Stuff. So it's exciting.
Griselda, then, which lands on Netflix on what day?
Thursday. Boydie? Thursday seems to be the new Friday for Netflix.
Thursday is the new Friday.
Yeah. Well, the big shows seem to start on Thursday these days.
Next up, we have Sexy Beast, otherwise known as Boydie's Gamertag. This is this is Paramount series, which acts as a prequel to the 2000 film and stars Stephen Moyer, Eamon Elliott, Sarah Green, and James McArdle as a bunch of London gangsters, the same people, in fact, played by the likes of Sir Ben Kingsley and Ray Winston in the original film. And in this one, they're undertaking a high-stakes job to steal a coin. Boydie, you sexy beast, you. Did this heist drama steal your heart?
Very good intro, by the way, James. quality level of jokes and puns in that intro. Well, first of all, I'm a huge fan of the film, of the original film. I think Jonathan Glazer's film came out in 2000, 20 fucking 4 years ago.
That's a long time.
That makes me feel really old. Yeah. I remember seeing the preview of that like it was yesterday. And the famous thing about Sexy, among many famous things about it, is that image of Ray Winston in his yellow
Speedos
sunbathing, oiled up as a Spanish expat. And the opening scene, I won't spoil it, has a very clever spin on that, which is not quite what you expect. So they acknowledge right from the off that this is... What's weird, though, this is set. That came out in 2000.
Yeah.
This is like the younger version of those characters, but it's in the 90s.
Set in the mid to late 90s. Yeah. So... it's basically them at the age they are in the film.
Exactly. Yeah. But they look completely different.
Yeah.
And much younger.
Yeah.
And they behave much younger as well. Like they're just so. I think I mentioned this last week, didn't I? But actually, watching it through, it is a bit weird that so much younger people and completely different looking people are playing the same characters. But go with it.
But also, fair play to Eamon Elliott because he's stepping into Ben Kingsley's shoes in that particular film.
Right. And part of what is absolutely brilliant about the original film, apart from Jonathan Glazer's incredible direction and the style of it and everything about it, it's just beautifully kind of delineated. But the cast was brilliant and Ray Winston was fantastic. But as you say, Ben was one of Ben Kingsley's absolute best performances. He's terrifying. He's like an embodiment of psychotic gangsterism. And he's so good in it. He's really, really scary. As you say, Eamon Elliott does a really good job of kind of acknowledging his acting style and his characterization of that person. James McArdle's, but they're all good. James McArdle's Gal and Raymond's character is very good as well. But he's a kind of more, he's the everyman figure.
I liked his character.
Yeah, he's good. Sarah Green, who we love generally as Dee Dee.
She's ace. Yeah. Bad sisters.
Yeah. And in the film, she's referred to as an ex-porn star. And we see her embroiled in the porn world very much in this series. And she wants to become like a porn entrepreneur.
An entrepreneur. I do love an entrepreneur. What kind of scenario?
You're picking me up on my...
That's good.
On a mistake.
But do you know the best thing about this is Darren will have cut mine out.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, she's a businesswoman who wants
entrepreneurial
to...
Entrepreneurial in many ways.
You're right.
It's been an episode of Gaslighting Boy.
Yeah, exactly. She wants to direct and star in her own porn films and she's finding that difficult to make that happen. Stephen Moyer plays Teddy, who was the character played by Ian McShane in the film, and there's kind of like a lot of people characters in this who are on various levels of psychosis.
Yes.
He is really sick and horrible, and I actually had to warn James about a scene of sexual violence that takes place in episode 2, and I won't say more than that, but his character, and it is fucking shocking, I tell you. Do you watch episode 2?
No, I only watch one.
This is full on, I should say, and I think it kind of has to be in a way, because it's, you know, it's all about how people become ruthless, nasty, sometimes sickening psychos in this world of in the world of gangsters, basically, and crime. And so I think it's valid. I'm not criticizing that, but it's definitely a lot. I would, you know, you really have to kind of gird your loins for some of this stuff. So it's really, really violent. But the character that was most incredible in this whole thing is
Tamsin Gregg's.
Yeah, it's the character of Don's sister, Tamsin Gregg, Cecilia, who's not in the film, and she is this maniac. She's again in the kind of top three psychotics in the series. She's maybe number one. And normally, normally I'm kind of resist prequelitis where they try and explain characters that you've grown to. So this tries to explain the Ben Kingsley character from the film, why he's such a nutter, he's the word advisedly. And it's all about his sister being insane and horrible to him and controlling in the most...
She's vile.
She's got a good line in Creative Insults, though.
She really has. Yeah. Her dialogue is amazing. But just Tamsin Gregg, the lovely Jewish mother from Friday Night Dinner, transformed into
from episodes,
from Black Books.
Horror. Yeah. Just amazing
she
casting.
She was one of my favourite things.
Whoever
about
cast
this.
Her, yeah, completely. But whoever's decision it was, the idea it was, to cast her in this role deserves an award, deserves a BAFTA, because you'd never in a million years think of her. But she's fucking brilliant in it. Absolutely brilliant in it. And I bought into the idea of there's even flashbacks to their childhood with her and the character of Don. And I wonder if I'm like, is that it's a bit simplistic, but another like, yeah, okay, you know, but there has to be some explanation of why he is who he is. And they go for it. So bottom line is, as a huge fan of the film, I enjoyed this. I think it's as good an attempt as you could do. If you're going to make a new spin-off, but prequel to a classic piece of filmmaking, then this is kind of the way to do it. I thought it was good.
I also enjoyed this, and I haven't seen the film, so I had no reference. But I really liked Tamsin Gregg, as we've discussed, and more importantly, it was the chemistry between Sarah Green's character, Dee Dee, and Gal, played by James McArdle, that I just thought was so electric. I just wanted to watch... I could watch the whole thing. Mm-hmm. If it was just on them, I would just absolutely lap
it
up.
It was so good. That particular, where they meet and then they talk all
I know,
night.
And they're just talking, yeah, and totally they just, like, that. Totally get each other. It was... I thought that was fantastic.
And he's engaged to another woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's got a husband or a boyfriend or something as well. Yeah.
I mean, details. Yeah. No, very important details. Also, Paul Kay from Afterlife. He was great in this. And I couldn't place him. I kept going to Boyd, who is he? And he was like, he's in Afterlife.
It's Thoros of Mir, the Red Priest.
And that,
That, and who do you play in Afterlife? Was he there?
Well, he's the shrink in Afterlife.
Yeah,
the awful shrink. Yeah, the terrible shrink. Yeah, the laddish shrink.
Yeah.
He just wanted to go out on the piss all the time.
So, I enjoyed this a lot, and I also loved the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, the soundtrack was good.
Yeah, soundtrack is it's a lot, though. That's the violence is not to be taken lightly.
No.
Like, it is quite a lot. It's almost just a little bit too much for me, to be honest, the violence in this. Like, it's quite stressful. It's quite uncomfortable.
Oh,
like,
you haven't seen episode two yet.
Yeah, and that well, quite. But the thing is, that's part of its effect, isn't it? That you are always... you're always uncomfortable in your seat. Like, you're always ever so slightly on edge because you're not sure what is or could happen next. Mm-hmm. Because these characters are all so volatile and so unpredictable and so psychotic. It's a lot. It's really gripping. Yeah. Mm. Good stuff.
We're in agreement.
A Very Sexy Beast, then. This one comes to Paramount Plus when Boyd.
Thursday as well.
Big Thursday.
Yeah.
Finally this week, we have Trigger Points, which returns to our screens after an... explosive first season, in which Vicky McClure's bomb tech Wash foiled a plan to blow up London. Kay, is this a dynamite second season?
It is. And I've got to just say, I actually didn't watch the first season, so I've got nothing.
It's really good. It's really good. I watched all of it, albeit late. I think I watched it last year, as I recall. I went through and watched it all. So yeah,
I
loved it.
I need to. It's made me want to catch up on the first series.
Great.
It was 2022's best performing drama, apparently. So yeah, it's obviously very, as you say, explosive. A lot happened in the first season. Don't worry if you didn't watch it, though, because there's a handy recap at the beginning of the second series, which I thought was really good. And as you say, Vicky McClure is Lana Washington, an explosives officer in the Met Police bomb disposal squad, who got into all kinds of hairy situations in season one. In season two, when we find her, she's just been on a secondment in Estonia, training Ukrainian expos. And she's now back home giving talks to financial companies about terrorism when, in the background, there's a massive explosion.
Yep.
It's at a power plant, which she rushes to. She's not on active duty yet, but she's the closest. So, of course, she goes to attend the scene and has to disable an IED, which is attached to the gate, because the fire is raging and is going closer and closer to the transmitter. Is it transmitter? Transporter? Something? The something.
Transmitter.
Is it
transmitter? Don't think no, it's a transmitter. It's a power station. Yeah.
Transformer.
Sorry. Okay.
Oh, he's getting a bit snooty. It's a transformer.
Agreeing with you, Kate.
No, no, James was getting snooty. Yeah, let's not all lash out each other.
A lot of lashing out.
No, but he was being snooty to you. It is a
apologies
transformer.
Apologies for my snootiness. Yes.
Snooty McGooty. So the transformer inside, the fire's raging and the fire brigade needs to get in, but obviously needs to get through these gates. So she has to deactivate and sort that situation out. But
you are just retelling the entire episode.
Yes, I know. But it's very complicated. And basically, so it's a different word I was going to use then. And it wasn't Snooty Magooty. There's a lot. And what I love about this is that it's so fast paced and there's so much that happens in this first episode. And as well as like being, you know, the logistics of trying to sort the situation out and stop everything from going kaboom, it's the fact that she's back with her old team.
Yeah.
A lot's happened that I can, you know, gather, even though I haven't seen the first series. And also her ex is there, and it's about that dynamic, which I found really fascinating, especially because it's so interwoven with this kind of explosive situation, literally.
Yeah. Her ex, played by Mark Stanley of Happy Valley fame.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Dodgy Happy Valley,
yeah.
And Game of Thrones fame,
yes,
as well.
Yes.
I found this very enjoyable.
There's something inherently gripping and stressful about someone tinkering with something that could blow up. Like, fundamentally, like, they've got the perfect high drama situation. And I will not spoil it, but one of the things that you feel about, yeah, oh, it's not going to blow up, is it? And they're like, well, actually, having seen season one, it really could do. So, you know, they don't mess about with this. So I think they established stakes with this show very early on, and it stayed with you. Like, you're on edge all the way through. And a lot happens in this first episode as well. Things blowing up left, right, and center. I mean, it's really, really stressful. I cannot wait to watch the rest of this. I cannot wait. It's so much fun.
Well, it's got the stamp of Jeb Mercurio, hasn't it? I mean, it was created by Daniel Brilley, who wrote the whole of the first series and co-writes the second series with other writers. But it's definitely got that stamp of Jeb Mercurio, I think. And it's got, because it's the brilliance of Line of Duty, of all of his shows ever, and I'm probably giving him too much credit, but I'm sure he gets involved in the storytelling and the script and looking at the scripts, etc., is that the pace is so frenetic, and anyone can die any minute, as you're alluding to, James, in the situation where they're, and in this first episode, there are so many bombs on their IEDs of all different kinds, things you can step on, things that are bombs that are being flown around in drones, bombs that have been planted. You know, it's like everything's Bombie McBombface.
It is Bombie McBombface. Everything is blowing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're right. But so they take that inherent tension in her job, in the situation, and ratchet it up to like almost, it was borderline absurd.
It was. In the way that the first series, I think it began in quite a grounded,
yes.
I mean, things still blowing up, yes, but grounded. This was almost like 24 territory.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah. They've literally sat there and gone, how bomby can we make the first episode of season two?
What is the maximum bombage we can embody?
Yeah, and they've really achieved it. But brilliantly. And
if you were Lana, you'd take it really personally, wouldn't you? The amount of stuff that's thrown at her.
Yeah. She's been off helping people in Afghanistan, is it?
Ukraine. She's been training Ukrainians.
Helping Ukrainians with their bomb issues. And then she comes back and the whole of London is like being bombed to shit by some weird, mysterious people, kind of terrorist type people. But they, what they do very cleverly, again, very similar to Line of Duty, is without kind of emphasizing the point, they interweave the what's happening in their lives. And it just happens, she, you know, her ex is a colleague, that the Mark Stanley character, and there's another guy who's a racist who kind of is trying to he was suspended and now he's back on duty.
Yeah, and she's not happy.
No, and he's trying to blatantly over befriend a black character to show he's not racist. I thought that observation was really clever. That he's literally, he loves me now. I was like, does he really? No, and he doesn't. You're still a fucking racist. So they weave all of that stuff into the incredible excitement and thrill of the storylines very, very cleverly. And as James says, it's really addictive, isn't it? Because it's so fast moving and anyone can die, presumably except Vicky McClure, basically.
Yeah.
That,
or just, you know what? You can't take it for granted. There was a part of me that thought, will they just kill her in the first episode?
Oh, like,
They could have done.
I mean, yeah, they could have done.
You never know.
It's her show, though. I think that would be.
Although I will say also, like, I very much enjoyed Just Like London. She's, oh, mate, how you doing, mate? Oh, mate, I'm fine, mate.
Yeah, totally, yeah. There is a lot of that. Totally. But yeah, it's great. And she's just phenomenal. It's a brilliant role for her. Everyone in it is really good, but she just, you are completely convinced that, as everyone keeps saying, she's the best. Mm. She's the one who can sort it all out, and, you know, yeah. And she is.
Trigger Point, then, which comes to ITV on Thursday. Sunday. Damn it.
Sunday.
On Sunday.
Sunday, the thing of what's it?
Sunday, the thing of what's
it. To get everyone nice and stressed before work on Monday.
That's right. True,
Bommy McBomface, then, on ITV.
It's not cozy Sunday night viewing, I have to say.
No. Not at all.
Yeah, but that is the slot it's got.
That is true. Right, what else is on this week? Now, we mentioned Expats, Lulu Wang show Expats, which you heard about from Lulu Wang herself. That lands on Prime on Friday, but is embargoed, so we cannot cover that, unfortunately. Masters of the Air, which is the big World War II Air Force drama, huge thing, arrives on Apple also on Friday. It is also embargoed, but we will be covering that on this week's Pilot Plus. What else we got now? Boyd, I know you were very disappointed that we didn't get to... we didn't get to review Masters of the Universe Revolution Season 2 on Netflix, which I know you're a big fan of and we're very upset about.
I'm a big Kevin Smith fan, so I actually, you know, I did watch some of the first season because he makes that show, doesn't he? Or writes it.
He's involved, yeah. Sky Witness also has Fire Country, which is that police... Is it fire procedure? Is it fire engine procedure?
It is, but it's prisoners. People have been in prison transforming their lives and becoming fire people. Andrew, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, this is the highest rated drama in America last year, because they showed it after the Super Bowl, and so it had a massive, massive audience. Yeah, and it's become like a big hit.
So it's ex-cons who become firemen.
Yeah.
And it's not a reality show, it's actually a drama.
No, it's a drama, James. Yeah.
Right.
That starts on Sky Witness. Did you say that?
Can I get a Sky Witness? Yes.
Yes. The final of
the final of The Tourists, where Jamie Dornan faces off against...
Probably the reason I made that mistake is the final episode of The Tourist is on next Sunday.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Good. If you haven't caught up with it all on iPlayer, by the way.
Right.
But The Traitors final is on next Friday.
How come it's over so quickly? How many episodes have you had?
It's only, basically runs for 4 weeks, 3 episodes a week.
That's not much.
No, I agree, but that's good.
Is that not too little?
No, because every episode is big, is full of stuff, yeah. So it's
if I know it was only four episodes, I would have considered watching it.
Oh my God.
James, come on.
No, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
3 episodes a week.
Oh, 3 a week?
Yes.
Fine. I thought it was 1 a week.
No, I'm not watching
3 episodes a week.
No,
you're joking.
Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Fuck that.
Right, yeah. So it's enough episodes. Yeah, steady. Yeah. I think that's about it. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Guys, listen, breaking news. While you were just talking, I thought, let me just see about the review situation, you know, because I knew you were going to do a little bit of a shout out for it. In the last 2 days, we've had 6 reviews.
Wow.
It's work. The nagging is work.
Oh, I should mention, someone did point out you can 100% leave ratings on Spotify. So if you are not in the Apple ecosystem and you do subscribe to Spotify.
I don't think you can leave reviews, but you can leave ratings.
Star ratings, yes. And frankly, even if you have left us an Apple star rating, would it kill you to go and leave us a Spotify one as well? I don't think it would.
Basically, we want it all.
We do.
Yeah.
We want all of these things. So if you did enjoy the show, if you did love it, please do go and leave us a 5-star rating on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
And to be fair, even if you didn't, please do it anyway.
What is our pick of the week?
I'm going to support Sofia Vergara. I'm going to go for Griselda.
Okay. Boydie?
Yeah, I think I agree. Yeah, I think that's the biggest surprise because, I think that's the biggest surprise. Yeah.
I had the most fun with Bommy McBomface.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with that. Although that said, who knows? It might be Masters of the Air. You have to wait to Pilot Plus to find out.
True.
Next week, on next week's show, we are going to be covering, I think, Mr. and Mrs. Smith on Prime, as long as it's not embargoed.
Yeah.
Black Cake is on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
And there are probably some other shows, but there's nothing on the calendar because neither Boyd nor Kay have put shows in there. So.
I don't like the calendar and I'm opting out.
Fair enough.
There's a witchy fantasy show called Domino Day on BBC Three.
Sold.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. It's very James.
Witchy
very
fantasy. James.
Yeah.
I'm there.
Why did you have to say it out loud?
Well, because we have to do it. We can't ignore it, Kay.
It's going to be brilliant, Kay.
Yeah.
Witches, fantasy, glorious. Well, that's it. That's it for this week's show. Thanks again. As we said, please do leave us a rating. And
And any questions or thoughts or feelings?
The ending of this is as shambolic as the rest of the podcast. Yeah.
This has been an unusually shambolic show, I think.
That was partly me.
The thing is, our listeners may or may not be aware of the extent of the shambolism. Yeah. The fact that...
Till at the end of the year when Darren does his blooper reel.
I lost the power of thought at one point. Kay lost the power of speech.
We had to stop for a full... Like, must have been 5 minutes while Kay laughed hysterically.
Yeah, so. I'll tell you what. It is going to be cut out the main bit, but I will just say that I got into such a bad situation that I couldn't... James looking at me put me off.
So I was forced to stand basically in the corner.
Yeah, and Boyd was forced to stare at a wall. So.
This is the stuff you're missing.
Dear. Yeah, quality entertainment.
Amazing. Right, for more of this fun, do join us next week. Until then, pilot out.